Welcome. My name is Peter Berg. I'm head of special collections here in the MSU Libraries, and I would like to welcome you to tonight's reading. I'd like to introduce to you Peter Levine, who is our reader tonight. Born and raised in Brooklyn, a graduate of Columbia and Rutgers, Peter Levine has been teaching in the history department at MSU since 1969, the year he left graduate school. Trained originally as a Jacksonian political historian, Levine's scholarly and writing interests have expanded to encompass the entire 19th century and beyond, to engage in a wide range of interrelated themes and topics, including the immigrant experience and assimilation, American Jewish history and culture, and American popular culture. Peter Levine is best known for his work in sport and American social history, especially for his books, A.G. Spaulding and the Rise of Baseball, Idols of the Game with Robert Lipsight, and Ellis Island to Ebbets Field, Sport and the American Jewish Experience. He's also known for his novel, The Rabbi of Swat, which deals perhaps in a more personal way with issues presented in his historical works. In addition to his lives as a scholar and novelist, Peter Levine has also enjoyed wide recognition for his acting throughout Michigan. He recently completed the lead in a new play performed in Ann Arbor, and you may remember him as Matthew Brady in Inherit the Wind, Buffalo Bill in Indians, or Roy Cohen in Angels in America, all performed here on the MSU campus. I have known Peter Levine since 1980. He has served as my mentor, my confidant, my guide, and my counselor. He is my friend. It gives me great pleasure to introduce to you Peter Levine.
Thank you, Peter. See if I can get there without falling over the chair. Since you don't mind if I sit here, there's so few people. Even if there were more, I'd probably sit here. I hope no one's going to be really disappointed. And if you are, you can tell me, and I can always do something different. But when Peter asked me to do this, I was very flattered to be considered a Michigan writer, which to me is sort of an oxymoron, since, as you'll see, what I'm going to talk about tonight has nothing to do with Michigan, although I've lived here for 31 years, longer than any place else, although you wouldn't know that from my voice or my sensibilities in some ways. But when I saw the promotion material about novelists, I thought, gee, that's sort of presumptuous. I did write a novel, sort of a virtual book that's sort of out there. And Peter's right, it is about things that I've written about before, very personal kinds of things. Novelist is a bit presumptuous. Writer, yes. I actually thought I might begin today by reading to you from my very first book, The Behavior of State Legislative Parties in the Jacksonian Era, which actually sold a copy last year. So it's still out there, so to speak. Hey, Steve. But I thought, you know, that would be a little much to ask of your patience. And as Peter suggested, from that start, I've moved on to other kinds of things, writing books about sport, about the immigrant experience that have been meant for more popular as well as an academic audience. And a lot of those books, more and more I realized as I went back and looked at them, I discovered something that somebody once said who's very famous, whose name I can't remember, which happens when you get a little older, that ultimately writers write about themselves. And I've been doing more and more of that more openly. And what I'd like to share with you tonight, only because I've never done it before, is what I've been writing recently, if that's okay with everybody. And if not, you can tell me and I can stop at any time, and I can always do this, but I've done this to death on this campus, and I really don't really want to do it again, but it's really not a bad read, and I can tell you a little bit about it later. And mostly, when I talk about writing about myself, I'm really talking a lot about writing about where I've come from, and about my father and me, and what we had and didn't have together. And 2 years ago, 3 years ago now, I got a wonderful opportunity, which has turned it out to be, I guess, what I'm most engaged in now. Fall of 97, I had a sabbatical. I learned a long time ago, when you can take it for the whole year, you should, and so I did. And I went to New York, where I'm from originally, where my daughter now lives, for 4 months in the fall by myself to live in the Village. This is Greenwich Village, for those of you who are not from New York and don't know that part of the world. To do three things. One was to work on a book that I am still working on, which whether I'll finish it or not is beyond me at this point, a book about Death of a Salesman, a play that I'm very connected to both as an actor and as a person who teaches American history and who also loves the theater. And it's a different kind of book. It's not an academic book. It's a book that deals with everyday people and their reactions to the play and why this play has had such legs over 50 years. And so a lot of it involves talking to actors and directors. I've had wonderful conversations that I've taped and that Mark has transcribed, not all of them, however, with Arthur Miller and Dustin Hoffman and Brian Dennehy and the like. And I should do something with this stuff, but I haven't. Because the other two reasons I went to New York have sort of intruded. One was to just go back and see what it would be like to live there again. My wife and I came out to Michigan in 1969, and we've been here ever since, much to our chagrin at times. And that's going to change relatively soon. And the third reason was to pursue my interest as an actor. I thought, well, here's an opportunity to see what it would be like to be in New York as an actor, to take classes, to audition for plays, and actually to even be in a play. And I did all three of those things in 4 months, so I was very lucky. And in the midst of all this, my friend Bob Lipsight, who some of you may know from the New York Times and who I've worked with before, said, you know, you ought to keep a journal. There's probably an interesting book here. So I did. And I came back, and I've been working on this journal over, working it over and writing it. And I'm about three quarters of the way finished with the first draft of a book, which I guess is an uplifting middle-class Jewish memoir, as opposed to another depressing Irish one, right? I figured there should be a market for that in New York. And what I'd like to do, if people don't object, is to read you the opening of this book and then one short chapter. And then if you really can't stand it, I'll stop at that point and I'll definitely read you the sex scene from the Rabbi of Swat. So you won't, you know, it's cold out, you won't be home going home disappointed. Is that okay with everybody? Okay. And I never read this out loud. I was telling Jane before, when we did an interview, that I'm a writer, but I'm also, it's what I hear that's important. I read this out loud to myself and to my wife and to my daughter, but how it sounds is important to me. So keep that in mind. This is a rough draft. Some of this was written when I was 53. I'm not anymore. There's relations to people in here that occasionally I may have to identify, but hopefully this will work. And if not, you know, I'll find out. So this is the opening of the book. The working title of the book is He's So Vanya. I'll have to change that because this will not sell anywhere, but it worked for me to get into this, all right? So here's how it goes. I am 53 years old, a native New Yorker born and raised in Brooklyn, a Midwestern Michigan resident for almost 30 years, a husband, a father, a teacher, a writer, a more than slightly balding white American man, a bit over 6 foot tall, a bit under 200 pounds. I'm now 177, so I'm now quite a bit under 200 pounds. And on this particular cool, windy, rainy Saturday, November morning, I am very nervous, but determined. Sleep did not come easy. I'm up early and deep into Uncle Vanya, even as I shower. By 10:30, I've reread the play again, and I'm out the door of my West Village apartment, headed for the Actors Center on Broadway and 27th Street for my 11 a.m. acting class. If you came for the Rabbi of Swat, hang in there. Today, David and me will put up our scene for the first time. The mile walk passes quickly. Vanya's lines from Act 4 and his confrontation with Astroff, my major preoccupation, as I wind my way through the usual array of New Yorkers. Dog walkers, shoppers, runners young and old, alone and in pairs, a gray-haired old woman dressed in black, hobbled but hardy, finding her own space among the rush of people that pass her by. All out and about, numbers thinned a bit by the rain and the wind, their umbrellas all but useless against the elements. David arrives soon after I do. We run our lines and then take our seats, along with our classmates, in one of the two studios that takes up most of the center's 17th floor space, a 40 by 30 room with a high ceiling, hardwood floors, old casement windows shrouded in red velvet curtains, and wrapped around three sides with New York vista views, and the most uncomfortable little black wooden slatted chairs I have ever encountered. Some 8 of us are here today, equal numbers of men and women, all excluding me in their mid-20s to their mid-30s. And of course, our teacher, Earl Gister, about to retire as a master teacher from the Yale School of Drama, a charming, exuberant, warm man in his early 60s, casually dressed in slacks and a sweater, who relies on an amplifier pressed to his larynx to be heard. Okay so far? Hanging in there? Okay. Two of our classmates go first. I will read you the sex scene. I don't want to disappoint anybody. Two of our classmates go first. They, too, have chosen a moment from Uncle Vanya, the famous pencil scene between Astroff and Yelena from Act 4 that actually follows the one that we will be doing. Earl takes them through their paces, as he does with all of us, questioning them on their intent and their actions, encouraging them to make bold choices, to go for big objectives, to approach the scene in ways that engage their emotional life, and that make them look to each other as a source for their feelings, all the time explaining to them and to us the meaning of the scene. As always, it is a riveting tour de force. An hour flies by as Earl pushes and pulls, preparing the actors for their presentation. And then they go. We watch as Earl stops and starts them time and again, questioning, encouraging, listening, before concluding with another discourse about the craft. We take a short break, some to smoke outside on a narrow fire escape, most to relieve themselves from the pressure and excitement of the class. Meanwhile, David and I provide a minimal set for our scene, a table upstage with a bottle and two glasses, chairs downstage arranged as a sofa. The class reconvenes. We take our places and Earl motions us to begin. My state is Vanya's, or so I think. I have just botched an attempt to kill an old professor whose young wife I lust after. I am in deep despair, desperate for some reason to live, and there is fear in the household that I might kill myself. Astroff, the local doctor and my closest friend, is after me to give back a vial of morphine that I have taken from his medical bag. I can feel my heart pounding inside my chest, my head lightheaded, as I come through the door onto the set. David follows a few steps behind me. I walk into the middle of the room, stop, turn back to him, and scream, "Leave me alone!" Then turn and walk casually down left away from him. But before he can barely blurt out, with the greatest of pleasure, Earl is on his feet and in our faces. "Do you want Astroff to leave you alone?" he asks. "Yes," I reply, at least at the outset. Earl smiles, that devilish, puckish grin that supports both his interest in what we're doing and his constant amazement in how we so often miss the obvious. "I don't see it," he begins, and proceeds to draw out from the class the discrepancy between my words and my physical state. How my lackadaisical, shuffling hands and pocket walk and my decision to cross to center before delivering my line denied the urgency with which I spoke the words. I can feel myself turning red. David, embarrassed for me, turns his head. I feel naked and alone. The stupid smile on my face is poor mask for the insecurity that radiates from me. But I'm determined. "Do it again," Earl demands. "If you don't want him in your room, let us see it." David and I leave the room and prepare to begin again. I feel a surge of energy and a surprising focus that I did not have before. I punch him in the arm a few times. He's startled and punches me back. "Okay, let's go," I say, and we're back in. But this time, as soon as I step in the room, I'm in his face, words, body, and feelings connected. We go through one exchange before Earl stops us again. This time, David center stage. Imagine teaching like this. How do you need to make Vanya feel to get what you want from him? What does the text tell you? David tries several answers to no avail before Earl leads him to see that the most actable choice is foolish. "Go for it," he implores. "Send the message to him right away. Make it big and clear. Don't inhibit your choice." It takes us several times before we both begin to truly play off each other and the scene starts to flow. All the blocking and decisions we discussed and rehearsed together are out the window as we reinvent the scene and bring it alive. I can see it in David's face, sense it in my soul, and feel it in the air. We move downstage left. I'm the desperate fool now, ranting at those who have injured me, hoping to make Astra feel my desperation and offer me some hope. "It's strange," I say. "I try to commit a murder, but they don't arrest me or drag me into court. It must mean that they consider me mad. I'm a madman, but those who cover up their mediocrity, their stupidity, the ellipses are mine, not Chekhov's. Desperately in the moment, my body reddened and quivering with emotion, my voice deep and resonant, I struggle both for Vanya's soul and for his words that have escaped me. But no words come, even as we stay intensely connected, me and Vanya, David and me. I hear a few laughs as the struggle continues, and then Earl intervenes. Up quickly from his chair, he turns angrily on the class, displaying a side of him that I have never seen before. "Why are you laughing?" he admonishes the class, instantly transforming this group of intelligent, talented, professional actors into a gaggle of embarrassed five-year-olds. "He doesn't know whether you're laughing at him or with him. This is a rehearsal, not a performance. I don't give a fuck about the words. Fuck 'em. It's what we see and feel that's what's important." There is timid silence, and then Patrick finds the courage to speak up. "Of course we're laughing with him, Earl. He's so Vanya." Title. We finish our scene. I struggle through another long speech in which I implore Astroff for some hint on how to begin life anew. These are the words of Chekhov. "I'm 47 years old. Let's say I live to be 60. That leaves me 13 more years. That's a long time. How can I get through those 13 years? What will I do? What will I fill them with? Then Earl spends the next 10 minutes pointing out what he both liked and found wanting in our work. For the most part, he's pleased. Show Vanya to be even more vulnerable and desperate than you are, he tells me, even as he puts his hand on my shoulder, squeezes it gently, and tells me that you did beautifully. You're at a stage in the process, you just need to go further. Don't be afraid to push yourself. I'm elated. And suddenly somewhere else, back in Brooklyn, back almost 40 years, sitting at my desk in Mr. Philip Rodman's Honor Bright English class at James Madison High School, nervously anticipating the return of our term papers. Mr. Rodman comes by my desk, stops, smiles at me, then puts my paper on some now forgotten aspect of Ibsen's plays on it. Wonderful job, he says, pats me on the head. I don't remember the grade, but I've never forgotten the touch or how it made me feel. Feelings of care and confirmation that Earl rekindles for me. Don't let all this praise go to your head, David jokingly taunts when we rehearse our scene 2 days later, but it's too late. There's still another month to go in New York, but I'm on my way. This is the story of my return to New York. Unlike Uncle Vanya, I came back with a strong sense about how I want to spend the remaining years of my life, about what I will do and how and what I can fill them with. I want to be an actor. What better place to go to take classes and to test the waters, to see if my fantasies, the things that, quote, go to my head, have any basis in reality, to see what it would be like to live in New York again after 30 years in the close quarters of a small Midwestern university town, to see if Thomas Wolfe was right. I'll probably cut that line. Unlike Uncle Vanya, I'm not depressed about how I have spent the past 30 years of my life. I have had a very successful and full career as a university history professor. I've written books that have been reviewed in the New York Times, crossed the country on book tours, been on radio and television, even written a novel. Always a popular teacher who takes seriously my responsibility to help young people develop their ability to think and express themselves, I have taught everything from Jacksonian politics to the politics of sport. I have been married for 33 years to my childhood sweetheart, and I have a sweetheart of a daughter, about to be married to her first love. I live in a lovely home with easy access to the river I love to row on. Except for the uncertainties of life, which I've experienced lately, that none of us can control, there is no reason to think that what I have could not continue pretty much as it is. But I have decided to return home and begin again. This is a story of that decision, full of many returns and new beginnings, of ordinary moments unexpectedly transformed, of the intermingling of the present and the past, of people then and now, of fathers and sons, of daughters and fathers, of memory and history, of reality and fantasy, of discovery and confirmation, a personal journey of self, hopefully with meaning for others. So that's the introduction to this. Could I read one more chapter of this? Is that okay with everybody? You sure? We could take a vote. This is a little longer, but I like this chapter. Anyway, and I like some of it. Some of it needs to be changed. But I'll try this, and then I'll read the sex scene, and then answer any questions that you have. And let me just preface this by saying that what happened as I started to write this is this book just went back and forth. And, I mean, it's surreal for me. It's half the time I'm back in Brooklyn and here and with people who are dead and alive, and it's been very weird. And this chapter has some of that in it. Be a clown, be a clown. All the world loves a clown. So the words go to a song I have known since I can remember, even if I can't remember when I first heard it. Was it Donald O'Connor on the silver screen, Judy Garland somehow lurking in the background? I know it wasn't the television clowns I grew up with, Emmett Kelly, Red Skelton, or Red Wynn, naive, big-nosed, floppy-shoed men not known for their singing, and not Milton Berle, even if his cross-dressed openings every Tuesday night might qualify, although I have fond memories of those nights when my father gave me a bath and we tried to guess what woman Uncle Milty might be when the men from Texaco introduced him. Lyrics aside, clowns hold no special appeal for me. I never cared much for the circus, certainly not the always present big mouth, baggy pants legions with their undersized cartoon cars. When I was a little boy, Sadie Pearson, my Aunt Harriet's best friend, once took Jeffrey, my cousin who I grew up with, and me to Madison Square Garden, the old garden on 49th Street between 7th and 8th Avenues, to see the Ringling Brothers Barnum and Bailey extravaganza. What I remember most is being frightened by the freak shows and eating cotton candy. I understand Marcel Marceau's genius, but I hate mimes. But becoming a clown, or at least making the attempt, turned out to be the most unique acting experience I encountered in New York. Nowhere did I go for it more or explore myself more fully than in Chris Bayes' clown class. So this is a chapter about this class. Chris was my youngest teacher, in his early 30s, bespeckled, curly-haired, short, wiry, and gentle, always on the verge of a laugh or a giggle, yet quite serious about his craft. And craft it is, he tells the eight of us when we meet the first time, huddled around him in a semicircle on our little black chairs, again mostly strangers to each other, although Elizabeth and Darren are in my audition class and Sarah joins me in voice. What would you be like, he asks, if you had never been told no? If you didn't know what it was to be or to do something inappropriate? The question is rhetorical, and Chris fills in our silence. What you would find is the clown in all of us. And that's what this class is about. Not floppy shoes, broad makeup, and fake noses, at least not for their own sake, but rediscovering and nurturing a muscle we all possess but that we rarely use. Like the Lion and the Wizard of Oz, it's courage that we're after. The goal, Chris tells us, is to build our courage muscle and to lose our self-criticism muscle. This is a perfect class for me. Instructed to live in a world without drawing attention to us. I can cut this. Clowns live on the edge, he tells us. Their emotions are always strong, not kind of or sort of or halfway. The process is painfully simple. No rehearsals, no lines to learn, nothing to do but show up twice a week and do what we're asked. Each class, Chris asks each of us to do certain things with the rest of us as an audience. Every task begins the same way. We leave the room and then we return. Each time we return, we do what we've been asked to do. Each time we enter, Chris insists we walk in an unfamiliar way. If we don't, he sends us back out to try again. Force yourself to change physically, he tells us, and it will produce unexpected vocal and emotional expression. And each time, for every exercise, he and the class provide instant feedback on how we do, whether we were authentic or not, whether or not our physicality, our walk, and our body language seem connected to our emotion and our voice. We begin by introducing ourselves. No big deal. Something we've all done thousands of times in our lives. So simple, yet so frightening. Or so it seemed, standing outside the studio door, waiting for my turn to enter, unsure of how to walk, what to say, or what would come out of my mouth. It's one thing to give a lecture on the slave South or to be a character in a play. I've done many both times. I know what it is to be nervous, but I've never had stage fright. There's always been some mask to hide behind. But now, in my very first clown class, strangely enough, it's just me. How terrifying. Where's that big red nose when you need one? I totter in, two steps forward and one step back, tripping over my feet as I tentatively approach my classmates. They smile at me, I look them over, and barely squeak out my name. Good, very good, Chris laughs as I scurry out of the room. Next time, he suggests, don't step back each time you step forward. Over the next few classes, we proceed from one exercise to another, each one a little more demanding. We try to make each other laugh. We walk on hot sand. We walk on ice. We sense the ice is breaking and that we will die. We realize that it won't and we'll be safe. We sing a song about our lives and learn something about each other. There's an American who has spent time in Italy, an Australian woman in New York for the first time, and me, a Brooklyn boy back in the Big Apple after 30 years in Michigan. We share our favorite toy. We tell jokes. We begin to discover our clowns, some of us more quickly than others. Putting on noses helps. 2 weeks into the class, Chris pulls out a bag of bright red rubber noses, each with the nostril holes to breathe through and an elastic strap to keep them on our faces. They come in all sizes. Noses are the anti-mask, he tells us. What did I know? Everyone pays attention to it. Instead of hiding behind it, it encourages you to reveal yourself more intensely. Choose one, and it does, actually. Choose one, he says. Wash it out with soap, and let's see what happens. I pull one out of the bag. Each nose has a code written inside of it. Mine says 4A. I laugh. It's the number of the Brooklyn apartment I spent my childhood in. How appropriate. I search now to become the free-spirited, liberated child I never was, wearing a nose that reminds me of the rich, if at times repressive, world that I came from. Nose is in place. We go through many of the exercises we have already done, adding some new ones along the way. By now, all of us can tell if we've entered out of sync. Our walk unconnected to our talk or emotions. We catch ourselves and turn on our heels before we're halfway into the room and try again, laughing at ourselves and each other at our recognition. But as Chris predicted, we do not all find our own clowns at the same time or in the same way. Emily and Judith come first. Emily must be Ruthie's age. It's my daughter, 28. Judith, 26 at this time. Judith closer to mine. Both are thin, finely featured women. Emily the Taller by a Head. Judith has been a dancer and an actress. Emily works in an office while she explores a theater in New York. But it's Lala and Jocko that I remember best. Emily is Lala, a sweet, innocent, floppy-legged, Raggedy Ann creature who bounces in with a song full of her name, la 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 la, over and over again, in one rhythm or another, depending upon mood and assignment. Judith is Jocko, a hunched-over specimen with a gorilla-like gait and gruff features that mask his painfully withdrawn nature. I fall in love with Lala, and even as I learn to overcome my fears about Jocko. Psy, that is, not me. Psy, I name myself, as we all do, comes out slowly but steadily, starting that very first day when I tottered out and introduced myself. But it's when I perform for my classmates, quote, a truly wonderful trick, that was the assignment for the day, several weeks later, that he fully takes shape. Lala helps me. I don't remember the details. I can't remember what the wonderful trick was. I enter with what now has become my walk, take center stage, and do my trick. I'm tentative. The words and the actions don't come easy. I search the crowd for approval, but it's clear that my own excitement does not match theirs. And then Emily laughs at me. Others join in. I feel ashamed and humiliated. I feel like I'm about to cry. Actually, I did cry. But instead of turning away or running out of the room, I stare at her, speechless now, choked up on the verge of tears. How could sweet Lala laugh at me? And Lala, she has become. Upset now with how she has made me feel. We are connected in the moment. That's a theater term, the moment, right? Even as it is happening, I remember how exaggerated and powerful my emotions were. I had brought a wonderful gift to share with her, and she had laughed at me. But now she understands that she has hurt me. She has caused me pain. Her face and body offer apology. That was something I could never make my father do. I gave him the gift of me, but more often than I care to remember, it was not accepted, at least not in ways that I could understand. I kept on trying, assuming the problem was mine, not his. Ashamed, nervous, and embarrassed, I turned away and ran out of the room more often than not, never demanding an explanation or questioning his reaction. But now Psy, in his own quiet way, expresses his pain and demands understanding. Although he still tilts and totters, he no longer steps backward. Instead, he lurches ahead, aware that he has something to offer that is worthwhile, himself. A week later, Psy surprises me again. We are to recreate our clown births. No one leaps up and volunteers, certainly not me. I watch Lala and Jocko, tiptoe too, and several others, whose names I can't remember, before I muster up the courage to try. Some take a few minutes, others as much as 15. Some hurriedly emerge, others come more slowly. Some seem embarrassed, others exuberant, Jocko just confused. Finally, I take my chance. My Columbia wool blue and white six-footer scarf in hand, it's actually back there, with it in my hand, I leave the room to prepare for Psy's birth. My college scarf is 36 years old. I bought it for Gail, that's my wife, when I was a freshman. Then it truly was 6 feet long. Now it's no more than four. Time will do that. For years, I've been 6 feet one. At my last visit to the doctor, the nurse informed me I was now 5'11¾". The scarf has become my New York shmata. Anybody need translation? You all need translation. Shmata is a Yiddish term for a baby blanket, okay? The scarf has become my New York shmata. I have vague memories of another one, a blue, worn, thin woolen blanket I carried around as a very young child. This one I wear everywhere. It keeps me warm. It comforts me. One day in clown class, we had to present a treasured object. I pulled it out of my coat pocket and used it. Now, unplanned, it gives Psy life. Door open, I lie on the floor, legs up against the jamb, the scarf covering my body from head to pelvis. I had clothes on, too. Slowly, very slowly, I fall off the door and lie still on the floor. Then, over the next 10 minutes, I emerge from the scarf and carefully discover myself, every inch and piece of me, part by part. My fingers, my hands, my arms, my toes, my feet, my genitals, sack by sack. I am a marvel to me. I feel it in my thoughts. I express it in my actions. I am in the moment. I sense an attentive silence in the room. I know that Chris and Lala and Jocko are watching me, but it doesn't matter. I don't need their approval anymore. I don't have to rely on them to confirm my worth. I simply enjoy me. My revelation was not entirely new that afternoon, but never did I feel it more profoundly. I have been learning more and more about me and my father ever since he died in 1973. Sometimes it has been a painful process. Always it has been enlightening and enriching, bringing me closer to him as I settle in my mind what was there for us and what was not. It's important work. The day Sai was born reminded me once again of my birthright, the right to enjoy myself, not selfishly nor in ways that hurt others, and not attached to the need for outside approval, even if I have struggled through much of my life in search of it. Ironically, it was my father, the man I sought it most from, who gave me this gift. Not with his frantic deathbed demand, born from the depths of his own frustration, that I live every day like it's my last, his hands grasping at my collar as he whispered his last words to me, cancer racing through his brain and body. No, not then, but in those few special moments when he allowed himself and me to see the possibilities. Don't you see him now? There, in the spotlight. The one that I hold on him as he sings and dances and twirls on the wooden social hall floor at Jaffe's Evergreen Manor to the sounds of Besame Mucho and Cherry Pink and Apple Blossom White. How happy he is. How happy he makes the people who watch him. How thrilled I am by his enthusiasm and by his joy. When Sai was born, I had no idea that the gift of enjoyment came from my father. 2 years later, 2 years after I turned in my rubber nose, it comes to me in a dream, even as our plans to return to New York move from dream to reality. In the dream, like my father, I'm a high school teacher. I'm at graduation. There's one student I especially want to congratulate, a nice, quiet, shy lad who I know I will never see again. Ceremony over, I find him as he's about to leave the auditorium. I put my arm around him. My eyes tell him how proud I am, but I say only two words. Peter, enjoy. He smiles and then leaves. Enjoy. Enjoy. Enjoy yourself, your life as it comes in the moment for its own sake. A version of my father buried more deeply in me than the demanding one whom I can never please, but part of me nevertheless. It's part of what I've always offered to Ruthie, a part now that my own flirtation with death offers to me. Clown class didn't officially end with my birth. Chris extended the class for another 5 weeks. I signed up again, as did Lala and Jocko. A few others stayed the course, and a number of new people joined us. Eventually, Sai got to dance with Lala. He even offered her his scarf as a gift, but she refused to accept it. Sai was disappointed, but not shattered. He still had himself. I like that chapter. Anyway, so that's what I've been doing. And I could stop now, but if you want to know about the Rabbi of Swat, I'll be glad to tell you about it. So it's up to you folks, really.